Aloha, and welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I'm Paul Leffler, and yes, I am on the island of Oahu getting ready to broadcast tonight's Fresno State football game against Hawaii. Maybe you're expecting me to be back at the Arizona Memorial interviewing a Pearl Harbor survivor. Nope, not this time. Today, it's a different twist, and you're going to hear several different perspectives. You know, I probably don't say this enough, but I want to thank you, the listeners, for helping me to honor our World War II veterans with this program. You send me tips about veterans you think I should try to track down, and that list just keeps on growing, so keep those coming. The whole premise behind that title, Hometown Heroes, is that you can find a hero in your hometown, someone who put his or her life on the line for our freedom, no matter where you live in this great country of ours. And today's program will provide evidence of that, I think, as we visit with veterans from all over America who converged on the San Joaquin Valley this week for the annual reunion of the 1255th and 138th Combat Engineer Battalions. Those units, and particularly the 1255th, were crucial in the liberation of Vianden. That's a gorgeous city in Luxembourg that's popular with tourists because of its historic castle. And in the shadow of that castle is a plaque honoring the men of the 1255th for their courageous efforts in liberating Vianden from the Germans in February of 1945. Before these engineers left Fresno this week, I was able to share a little time with them. It's a very diverse but extremely enlightening collection of stories that I trust is going to pique your interest today. Normally, we take the entire hour to delve deep into one veteran's experience. This time, you're going to hear from five different men, all from different backgrounds. Today, these five gentlemen live spread out. One's from New York, one in North Carolina, Oklahoma, Michigan, and Virginia. But in February of 1945, just after the Battle of the Bulge had concluded, they were all in Luxembourg. They were instrumental in liberating the last town in Luxembourg that was still under German control. So I'm going to take a short pause here, then come back and introduce you to Ed Garrison, Harold Mann, Bob Allen, Ralph Lund, and Clarence McClymans. Those are my guests today. We'll be right back with Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm sitting with a big group of veterans, part of a joint reunion of the 1255th and 138th Combat Engineer Battalions that chose Fresno for their reunion this year. Ed Garrison from Lynbrook, New York, is up first, and Ed, do you know how you guys ended up in Fresno this year? Because as I understand it, none of your members are from Fresno.
We've been meeting now since 1990, and we just choose 2 years in advance to go to a particular place of interest that will attract some of our veterans. And Fresno, 2 years ago, was suggested, and here we are.
So since you've been here, you've gotten to do a few things. You went up to Castle Air Museum and saw some of the planes that were a little more frequently seen back in World War II. You've been to Yosemite. You've been to the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. What's your impression of our area here?
Well, I'm completely unfamiliar with the center of California. And a week ago, when we were thinking about what we should wear when we came here, the temperatures were 101. And we almost discouraged enough of us not to come.
Well, I'm glad you stuck with it and came here, and the weather's been much nicer for you while you're here. Let's go back in time, if we can, and it's going to be tricky bouncing around with all of you today, but tell me about your story. How did you end up in the service during World War II? What were you thinking going in? I'm sure what you ended up doing was not exactly what you expected, but maybe if you can, paint that picture of initially this young buck getting into the service and what you thought you were going
to
do.
Well, to be honest, we wanted to get into the softest possible position. And the Army had a program where they sent the young men to college. No charge, and you were paid for being in the Army. And it looked like a good deal, particularly since we thought, well, the program would probably last until the war was over, and we'd all be safe. And that sounded good to me, so I enlisted in this program, which was called the Army Specialized Training Program.
And funny how things work. When there's a war going on, things can change in a hurry. And when they realized that they needed more people across the pond, all of that was interrupted. When did you find out that you would be going across the Atlantic to Europe?
Well, I think that was probably during or at the end of our basic training. The student group had to all have Army specialized, Army infantry or basic training. All units did. And after we finished the basic training, which was a 10 or 12 week program, we had maneuvers, and it became pretty obvious that things were moving in the direction of going overseas, since the other units that were training at Fort Jackson in South Carolina were also doing that. The infantry unit were being sent over. We figured we were in, we're going to go also.
Now, when we hear about engineers in World War II, I think some of the first things that come to people's minds, building bridges, fixing roads. You don't think of necessarily intense ground combat, or you think of maybe pulling up mines in a minefield. These are some of the things that come to mind. Was any of that close to what your experience actually was?
We actually did all those things. What came as a surprise was that when they took the word combat literally, we were, the title of the unit was the 1255th Engineer Combat Battalion. And we just assumed we would do engineer work in a combat zone. We didn't plan on actually doing the combat.
Now, had you had much training with firearms, either sidearms or artillery?
In your basic training, all the soldiers, no matter what their unit, what their type of activity was going to be, had to have basic skills in use of firearms.
So were you equipped with an M1 or a 45, or what did you have?
Most of the enlisted men had the M1 rifle. Some of the officers had carbines, and some of the higher-ups had pistols.
Now, you mentioned that you were surprised that they took the word combat literally. Tell me about your first taste of combat and how big of an eye-opener that was for you. I'm sure you knew one way or the other you were going to be in some dangerous situations, but was it a little jarring once you got in one of those situations?
Well, I think the big jarring came when we were in France, in Normandy, but our troops had advanced way forward to the German border, and we were suddenly shipped forward in the what were called then 40 and 8s, cattle cars. 40 meant 40 men, 40 hommes, or 8 chevaux, horses, 8 horses, either one. And there weren't many horses in our army, so we all count as cattle.
And I'm sure it wasn't too snug in those or anything, but where did they send you, and what did you see once you got there?
Luxembourg was our first entry into a combat area. And you knew you were in a combat area because suddenly you could hear the artillery, the American artillery, firing. This was the heavy artillery, 155s and so on down the list until you got to small arms. We first heard the big guns as we got closer and closer to the front.
Once you got to that front, what did they have you doing? And how much of a sense did you have that this is kind of crazy? And I imagine you're in Luxembourg. This is around the time of the Battle of the Bulge. You were shivering a little bit, too, not just from fear.
Well, I can remember praying that the Russians would get into Berlin very fast because we didn't want to have any part of it. But we went on patrol to find out, with infantry units, to find out what they were doing and how to best conduct ourselves. And that's about the experience we had. We had maybe a week of patrolling with the infantry.
So thrown right into the fire. And I'm going to make time for everybody else in the room here too, but you personally, is there one event, one instance that stands out in your mind that is the one that you can't forget about, that is still so vivid in your mind, you remember it like it was yesterday, where you really felt, this may be it for me. This is pretty intense stuff.
Well, it came all at once. We were just, from one day we weren't doing any fighting, and the next day we were. But the incident that stands out in my mind wasn't so much a deadly incident as it was a human experience.
All right.
We had finished the enemy resistance, the small arms resistance. We were still being shelled by the enemy on a road into a small town called Vianden in Luxembourg, which many people don't even know whether it was a country. Most of us didn't know whether they were enemy or on our side, because they spoke German. So naturally, they must be enemy. But when we had cleared the enemy soldiers, we were still under artillery fire, but we were blocked from entering the town because there was what was called an abattis, a group of trees that had been felled by the enemy across the road. And this was in a rainy, very cold, bleak morning, and we couldn't move forward with tanks or trucks or any equipment. That's why the abattis was dropped. And finally, one man in the outfit came forward, handed me his rifle, his M1, and with a pair of pocket pliers, wire cutters, went into this abattis. The official listing was 23 trees. I think that's a little exaggeration. He went in and disarmed all of the booby traps that were in that abattis without thinking. Well, to me, he just did it without thinking, but of course, he must have known what he was doing because there were trip wires all through the abattis, some of which, if you tripped over them, they exploded. Others, if you cut the wire and released the tension, they were exploded. And he went through there in semi-darkness in the rain, and he cut all those wires, removed all those, handed the mines out to us on the outside until it was, he said, it was all clear. And none of us doubted his word, and we then started to remove the trees. And the amazing part was that none of us said to this fella, "Wow, that was great," or "Thanks a lot, Gross, I can't believe it." We just did it. Nobody, he didn't get a medal. He wasn't thanked by the higher-ups. And that sticks in my mind more than any other event because it was a human event that I admired.
Well, it sounds like he probably should have gotten a medal for that because clearly he had no regard for his own safety. Would you have considered trying to do something like that?
No.
You didn't hesitate very long to give me that answer.
Well, a friend of mine was the other demolition man, and he put into writing his thanks that this had happened, that he didn't have to do that job, because if he said if he had, he'd have blown up the whole unit.
Well, that's obviously an alternative that you weren't very interested in, but I'm curious what would have happened if Gross had not done that, if no one had been able to remove that barrier, what would have happened to your unit?
Well, that's hard to say because clearing the unit could easily have been done with a bulldozer, but the bulldozer would have been very attractive for enemy artillery. That's why the abattis was there in the first place. So it's very difficult whether we would try to build a go around it, or we would find another demolition man to blow up, or because the unit was far enough back that if it did blow up, he would be the only one to go.
Makes sense to me. Ed, thank you for telling me about that. I'm going to get on to some of your buddies here, but before I do that, tell me what you get out of this when you come to a reunion like this and you see guys that some of whom you may have known during the war, others you've gotten to know through the reunions. What do you get out of it? Why do you do it?
The first reunion I came to was in 1991, and what surprised me most was the emotional effect meeting these men after so long a time, and to find out what our emotional contact was, that it actually made me tremble to meet these men again after 45 years.
I can imagine, and we're going to get some other perspectives on that, too. We're going to take a break, come back with more stories from the 1255th Engineer Combat Battalion. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ. A little different feel this week. Instead of just one veteran, we've got a half dozen of them here. Hopefully we can squeeze them all into this hour. I'm going to talk now to Harold Mann, who makes his home near Durham, North Carolina, originally from Georgia, but here in Fresno this week for the reunion of the 1255th and 138th Engineer Combat Battalions. Now, Harold, we are hearing from Ed Garrison about that battle in Luxembourg, the town of Vianden. You were there as well, I guess on the other side of the city from him. What stands out in your mind when you think back on those events in February of 1945?
Two things come to mind. First, I lost my best buddy. I didn't see him get shot, but he died, and it took me 10 years to get over the pain of that. The incident I told earlier today concerned a man who was shot a yard to my right in a street close to the river that's the boundary of Germany and Luxembourg. And suddenly, after we had done a house-to-house search, the Germans opened up from across the other bank, and David Glatter, a Brooklynite, was shot in the belly, and a medic grabbed him and dragged him to the door sill of a shop. And, of course, I jumped in there, too. and he administered morphine, but a day later he died.
You said you were a yard away when he was hit?
Yeah.
What is that?
That's pretty memorable.
I can't imagine being in your shoes for that. What does that feel like? When, I mean, obviously, you're always thinking that's a possibility if you're in a combat area, whether you thought you were going to see combat or not as an engineer. But when that happens, are you not thinking at all? Are you just doing because you're in the heat of battle? Or does your mind go to that place that easily could have been me, and I got to try to save my friend?
I had no time to really think such philosophical thoughts because soon thereafter we got heavy 88 shelling down in that area, and we were pinned down because it was a narrow street, and on one side there was a mountain wall behind the houses, so we were trapped. So I thought my adrenaline was working, and I thought about getting the hell out of there. And so we went up to the second story of the shop we were in, and there was a big hole in the side of the second story, and we dropped down like Tarzan and grabbed the poles, horizontal poles, and what was a little garden in the next lot. And then eventually we were able to sneak out the front door, and the road curved, and we got out of there. So again, I didn't think much about getting away.
Now, I'm sure you had trained for that exact scenario, right?
Oh, sure. I watched Tarzan movies in the 30s.
Johnny Weissmuller taught you that.
Yeah, right. In his loincloth.
In his loincloth, which I'm sure you were much more thoroughly clothed at the time, and it was a lot colder than it was in the jungle. When you get back together with your fellow engineers in a reunion like this, do you think back like that and say, boy, that was such a close call. That could have been me. I wouldn't be here to talk about all these guys. And is it fun to look and see what everyone else has done with their life since then, when easily they could have been one of those 400,000 Americans killed in the war?
Indeed, it's marvelous. All of us meet people who have different backgrounds from us. And for us who are older, this is a newer experience, you know. In the Army, it really did meld together people from all over America. And so we replicate this experience in our reunions. We feel like we're one band of brothers.
Now, if that shell had hit you, you wouldn't have been able to become a history professor. Where were you a history professor?
Two places, one in Georgia, one in Virginia. For the longer time at what's now Radford University in Virginia.
All right. And as a history professor, I'm sure the rest of the guys in your reunions count on you to have the straight story about what happened. If you had to put in a nutshell the significance of the 1255th in World War II, how would you do that? Maybe that's not an easy thing to do.
That is not an easy thing to do. We were a tiny unit who did great things on 2 days only. In Luxembourg, there are many monuments to divisional units who were part of the Bulge, but there's only one monument to a battalion-level unit, and that's us.
And where is that, and what does it signify?
It's on the outskirts of Vianden, and it's on the top of a marker to our mother outfit, which did little during this battle. And it means that the Luxembourgers think highly of us.
Basically, you liberated their city?
Yes, and we've returned 1995, 2000, and 2005.
How were you treated when you got back there?
Unlike the French, they love us.
So I guess you're from Durham, North Carolina. Maybe a good analogy would be to say that when you walked back to Luxembourg, it was like Coach K walking into Cameron?
Indeed. Go Duke!
Before I move on to one of your fellow veterans here, is there anything that you'd like to say? And as a history professor, I'm sure that you took very seriously the task of passing history on to younger generations. When you think about your generation, the World War II generation, and the significance of what you did, what do you think is the most important thing that young people today need to know about the more than 16 million Americans who served our country in World War II?
This is not necessarily number one, but I was a Southern boy who grew up in the segregated South, and I sensed that the war was a war against racism, and we all got to see Buchenwald, and that imprinted itself in my mind heavily. And I came back to the Deep South believing that World War II was a war against racism, and I became a racial liberal.
Do you think that that would have been different had your side not prevailed in World War II?
Yes, of course. Think what would have happened if the Nazis had really been able to prevail in a truce, and their ideas had prevailed in America.
You'd be speaking German with a Southern accent?
I speak German badly. I used to say that I knew just enough German to get in trouble.
I wouldn't say that about you. Well, thank you for serving our country, Harold. We're going to continue now with another engineer in Fresno for the reunion this week, and you get a picture of how these young men were brought together from all points of the United States. We've heard from a veteran from New York, from Georgia, and now from Oklahoma. Bob Allen currently makes his home in Ardmore, Oklahoma. And Bob, I want to know, how did you end up in the 138th Engineer Combat Battalion in World War II?
I'm a little older than most of these people around here. I graduated from high school in 1941. I was one of two from Oklahoma to attend the Virginia Military Institute, Lexington, Virginia. On December 8, 1941, I enlisted in the Enlisted Reserve Corps, and I had just heard the best speech I think I'd ever heard in my life from Lieutenant General Charles E. Kilburn, superintendent of VMI, and a Medal of Honor winner. And he advised us to stay in school. We stayed in school, and in the spring of 1943, we were called to active duty. I was by myself, went back to Oklahoma, reported for duty at Fort Sill, went to Camp Hood, Texas, took a basic training, and at the end of that, I was sent to the University of Pennsylvania ASTP, Army Specialized Training Program. After two semesters, the ASTP was canceled. I was sent for no good reason to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and I joined the 138th Engineer Combat Battalion. I knew nothing about the engineers, nothing, absolutely. I trained with them. We, of course, went through all kinds of basic training, had all kinds of firearms, from M1 rifles to carbines to pistols to 30 caliber machine guns, 50 caliber machine guns, all type of weapons. And we trained, and we went overseas with the 138th. We went over on a Dutch ship, the New Amsterdam. We went across by ourselves, no patrol, got across in record speed, 4.5 days, and landed in Scotland at Glasgow.
Let me stop you just there for a second, Bob, and that was a nice description of this chain of events, but I want to go back. You said December 8th. 1941, and you talked about that speech by your superintendent there at Virginia Military Institute. Was that speech in response to the news of the attack on Pearl Harbor?
It absolutely was. General Kilburn had set up what defenses the U.S. had on Corregidor. He had been involved in that. He said, we're very weak over there. This was a tremendous surprise to him, but General Kilburn was an outstanding professional. He made a very inspirational speech.
Was there one thing that he said that you talked about staying in school, and he did that? But it sounds to me like you kind of got a picture of the future from him, or an idea of what was going to be unfolding and how your life was going to change.
Well, perhaps I did. But you remember now, I went to VMI in the fall, in September of 1941. Everything was horse-drawn. We had horse-drawn artillery, horse-drawn cavalry. We had infantry. Everything was horse-drawn.
Well, when you got across the pond, and you talked about that a moment ago, I guess the Germans still had some horse-drawn 88s, but technology, at least on the Allied side, had moved forward a little bit, right?
I have read, and I don't know that it's true, but it's in a book that Hitler's army at strength was 50% horse-drawn. I do not know that for a fact, but I have read it, and I did not see it. I saw some big Belgian horses over there that looked like they could pull anything, but I didn't see it in the German army.
We've heard from a couple veterans of the 1255th, and as you listened to them describe some of their experiences, was it similar to what you encountered in the 138th? Were you in some of the same places, or do you have a different story to tell?
I perhaps have a little different story to tell, because we were not in actual combat. We were a battalion hooked to the American 9th Army, which was to the north, and we were also with the British 2nd Army. We did things that perhaps they did. We cleared minefields. I remember one specific minefield where a sergeant was told to remove a German R mine. A German R mine is an anti-tank mine. It's 3 feet long and about 6 feet square, 6 inches square. And he moved that thing, and it was booby-trapped. You could not find a piece of his steel helmet. He was blown all to pieces. We had a very few, I don't think other than that, we had anybody killed in our outfit. But we did have some wounded. We were north of the 1255th. We crossed the Rhine on a floating Bailey bridge that was built the night before, and it did real well. Our unit was not responsible for building that bridge. We did build other bridges. We repaired highways. We did anything you were supposed to do.
When you look back, and I know these reunions give you a chance to reflect, to talk about some of the things you saw and hear stories of what other guys saw, when you think about your unit and yourself and the men you served with, what are you most proud of from what you did during World War II?
I was just proud to be there. I was proud to be a part. And I have thoroughly enjoyed meeting the wonderful people of the 1255th.
Even if they're not Sooner fans like you?
Oh, if I talk to them long enough, they've got to be.
It is Saturday afternoon, so we just can't avoid the college football talk. Remember, we'll have the Bulldogs against Hawaii with coverage starting tonight at 5:30 here on KMJ. I'm going to step away for just a moment, but then come back with two more veterans from the 1255th Engineer Combat Battalion. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Going to shift gears and get another perspective now from another gentleman at the reunion this week in Fresno. They've come from all over the country. This is Ralph Lund, who makes his home in Alpena, Michigan. And Ralph, the stories we've heard so far, guys were used to being in a group of other engineers and doing things together. You had a little more lonely task at times. You were a scout. Now, for our listeners who don't know what that means, tell us about what it meant for you to be a scout at this time in early 1945.
Well, I was involved in trying to pick up information from the enemy, which amounted to sending patrols out. And some of them were daylight patrols, and some were at night patrols. But I often felt that some of the information that I gained was not... didn't seem to be too important to the higher-ups.
Wouldn't be the first time that someone said that. Now, we've heard about this battle at Vianden. There's still a marker there in Luxembourg thanking your unit for liberating that city in Luxembourg. You were actually there 3 times before the battle on scouting missions. What kinds of things were you looking for? And did you ever feel like that was a little dangerous task to be so isolated?
Yes. And at the battle of, when the battle took place about, I was in that area 2 days before the battle. All the snow was gone by then. I came across 5 dead Germans in the middle of the road. Turned out they were in artillery, and they'd been there for some time. I mentioned that, of course, in my report. The day of the battle, the bodies were gone. It was really strange.
So your typical scouting mission, they tell you this is the area that we want you to check out, and you're out there, you're making notes, making mental notes, and coming back to present that information, in theory, for its strategic use down the road.
Right. But I felt that a lot of people didn't pay much attention to it. Some guy in the back sitting maybe a mile behind the lines, he's dreaming up these things. Well, we got to do something. And so they send you out. And one of the most foolish ones was to cross the river, the Aare River, and that's between Germany and Luxembourg, and get a prisoner or two.
Just find a random prisoner? That was your task?
Yes. Now, in this particular patrol, we had about 10 inches of snow still there, and I took 3 or 4 men with me. It was going to be a night patrol. We were going to cross the river at midnight. We had a rubber raft type boat, which was inflated with a cartridge of CO2. So we hung this thing in between two guys and another two. We went to this outpost that was on the river, and that was Army unit that had the foremost. I think there were three or four guys there in the house, and this everything else was gone. People were all gone. We got there 2 hours ahead of time, and when we looked the situation over, it was all white, snow. We had no white gear. The raft was coal black. And I said, you know, this is this is a suicide.
Well, it sure sounds like you're a pretty big target, because there's certainly no camouflage there in a sea of white.
Yeah, and I had to go across almost 40 yards or so to get to the water even. And then it wasn't too far to get to the other side. About half an hour before we were supposed to go at midnight, I'd been down looking things over. Full moon, by the way.
You just needed a little more help, didn't you?
And I had already made up our minds. We were either going to be killed on the river or taken prisoner. Most likely they'd kill us because they didn't have rations themselves. We were about to go, carry the stuff down, and the guy from the telephone that they had in their forward post there, he said, "Hey, you guys, they've cut it out. No, don't go on the mission." Jesus, everybody, a big relief.
Are you convinced that if that hadn't been the word, that you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me right now?
No, no way. We had absolutely nothing. Everything was against us. Full moonlight, dark uniforms, a black raft, and crossing a river and dragging the darn thing down to where the water. No.
So I guess that's when you're thankful for communication, huh?
Big part of this was, on our way back, following the line, a telephone line, we came across a black spot about this big. A mortar had severed that line. Mm. Now, if that had happened a little before, there would be no message whatsoever, and we'd be committed to go across the river, across the river at midnight. But I didn't think I'd ever be around. In fact, they had killed us.
Is that one of those ones that you say an extra prayer of thanks for at night?
Yeah, I think I've made quite a few. Well, I've had other similar experiences. I talked to the people in the town of Vianden, and they told me, they were saying, you know, they're tanks. Every night, they're tanks. See, Vianden has, they cross the Aura River, they're into Germany itself. But they'd be going back and forth on the bridge, and they said, there's a big buildup. So you tell that to people, too. Nobody listened to anything that was given.
I can see that this weighs on you, that the information you collected was not put into practice and maybe could have saved some lives if it was. Is that how you feel?
Well, sure, yeah. But there were a lot of those meaningless things. I just think we're going on patrol. I had another patrol. I took a lieutenant and a sergeant and two or three other guys, and that was a night patrol. And we were to go down to the river and see if we could find a possible place to go across. We got down to the river, and we could hear the Krauts talking on the other side and coughing. To get to the river, we had to go down to a road, and there was a railroad. And geez, I noticed some things hanging on a wire. And I went and read them, and it said mining on them, mines. I said to the lieutenant, "We're standing in a minefield." And he said, "A minefield? Yeah." I can't even use the expression that he used. But it came down to, "Lund, will you guide us out?" I said, "Yeah, okay."
No pressure there in a snowy minefield to find your way out without getting blown up?
I think what saved us, really, we had about 10 guys in that patrol, which is way too much. Anyhow, I took out in each foot, and I said, "Step in my footsteps." And that's how we got out of that. And we got up into an orchard, and we had a guy that I'd never had in patrol, but he talked all the time. And he had like a stage whisper, and he knew his yap, he could not keep his mouth shut. And the Germans heard him, and they opened up with machine guns. Jeez, everybody hit that snow. And after that, was one of the guys said, "Boy, yellow snow is not bad."
And after that, maybe there was a muzzle on that gentleman with the stage whisper, huh?
Never went on another patrol, nor did the lieutenant.
Well, it's very clear to me that that someone was looking out for you, and I'm very glad to be able to sit here with you and hear some of these stories.
That hits home. You wonder why. I've just given you a couple, but I've got many more that happened. So
I'm sure you do, and I wish we had time to talk about all of them, but I get the sense, just sitting here listening to you, that is something that has stuck with you and maybe motivated you through your life, because you didn't take that for granted, the fact that you had a life, that you were here, that you came back in one piece. Would you say that's fair to say?
That is very fair. Yeah, it's always in the back of the mind, why me? You know, you expose yourself time after time, different crews and that.
We have just a few minutes left, but it's been such a pleasure hanging out with the veterans of the 1255th and 138th Combat Engineer Battalions, having their reunion in Fresno this year. Where are you going to be next year? Clarence McClymans joins me now. He's from Charlottesville, Virginia, home of one of the most beautiful college campuses in the country at the University of Virginia. You're not going to be in Charlottesville next year, are you?
No, we're planning to go to Branson, Missouri, which we had a good reason to come here. We had lived in California for 12 years, so it's kind of, next week we'll be in Berkeley, we're going to combine that trip to Branson, a driving trip. I've got a sister in southern Indiana. My wife has relatives in southeast Missouri. We'll do Branson and go on up to Quincy, Illinois, which was where I met my wife, where two children are born, and that sort of thing.
That's perfect. It's funny how everything works together. Now, we heard about the importance of communication when we were talking to Ralph about his story and how communication saved his life. Communication was your job in the military during World War II. You were a radio operator, and during that Battle of Vianden, you were tasked to hop in a Jeep and drive up a hill and string some cables so people could communicate to each other. That sounds pretty simple, but as I understand it, it wasn't quite as simple as it seemed.
Well, our intentions were good, of course, but getting there before daylight so we could be in position without being observed was the trick. And we shoved off at 4 in the morning with our Jeeps overloaded. We had two Jeeps with both radios and fixed radios and telephone wire laying equipment. And we got one of the Jeeps stuck in the mud when we turned off the road and started across an open field to get in position in the woods behind the hill that separated us from the enemy, so to speak, in the town of Vianden. Well, got stuck. By the time we got unstuck, it was beginning to get daylight. So it made it kind of scary to even get to where we were supposed to be. But we did run the wire up into the hill, up the hill to the top where the forward command post was. This, I think, probably our battalion commander, I've never known for sure, but some of the main people were up there in an observing place so they could command the battle, so to speak.
So if you guys had not been able to perform that task to get that wire intact, it would have been a big handicap for your units in that battle.
Well, certainly from our standpoint. Ironically, at the end of the day, when I went up to bring the wire back down in the field phone, it was lying there with the wire disconnected. Somebody had kicked that phone, you know, just lying on the ground. And some of us have theorized about whether that was why A Company wasn't able to report to the colonel as they should have been able to. We don't know when the wire was kicked, but, you know, they were out of communication for a while.
Even after 60-plus years, some of those questions are still impossible to answer. But you got your job done, and then your job was to make it home. Now, you ended up being between the American artillery, the Allied artillery, and the German artillery. Could you tell the difference between the American 105s and the German 88s?
Well, after the shelling had been going on for a little while, we realized that we didn't have to crawl under something every time there was firing. The Americans, I think, were using 105s, and the Germans were using 88s. Well, those are I guess, comparable. Well, 88s were a lot better, but anyhow, about similar size. And we learned that an outgoing round made, to use a musical term, made a crescendo. The pitch would go up, and the 88s coming in, because they're falling in their trajectory, the pitch would be decrescendo. And so we only ducked half the time.
And believe it or not, well, you're sitting with me here right now, so we know that you made it back and it did work, but something didn't work the next day. You talked about that Jeep being stuck in the mud. It got you back, but what happened the next morning when you went to try to start it up again to move on to your next task?
We found that the clutch was totally burned out. It wouldn't move an inch. The next day we had to make other plans and go up on the to the other side, but still the American Allied side of the battle, and we had to set up radio relay stations to keep communication, because we didn't know whether the Germans were going to try to make come back or not. And some of our line companies stayed, I think, all night with the idea they would be there to head off the Germans the next day. So our relay station, then we found a barn up on top of the hill where actually we could see through a crack in the siding one of the pillboxes of the Siegfried Line. We were stupid for being there. I mean, if they'd known we were there, one well-placed round would have made kindling out of that barn.
If you can see them, they can see you.
That's really true. So we sat there and made our observations all day, cranked up the radio. We'd run the engine to do that, but we did that a little too long, and the battery went dead by evening. So we couldn't even communicate with anybody. Somebody going back, we hollered, send the truck, the wrecker up here, send us a new battery. And they came and rescued us under cover of darkness.
Ooh, sounds like scary stuff to me. But I'm running short on time here, but I do know that you're also the editor of the newsletter for your group, and at a time where so many World War II alumni groups, if you will, are disbanding because the membership is so few. You guys have a pretty healthy group still going here, and you have to keep in touch with all of them. As that editor of that newsletter, can you verify for me that all the stories I've heard so far today have been told before the same way and are pretty much true? Can I take your word on that?
You can take my word for the fact that if the stories are good, they're okay, and we'll run them.
That was a pretty good answer. Is there anything else, Clarence, that you would like to add, putting the finishing touches on your reunion here in Fresno and what you and your group experienced?
Well, certainly. Fresno, since we lived in California some years, probably we've been to Yosemite a number of times, but it was a pleasure to do it again with these good friends.
Well, the pleasure today has certainly been mine. I've got some new friends, and I think I can safely speak for Castle Air Museum, the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno, and all the other places you visited while you were here when I say that the 1255th and the 138th Engineers are always welcome here in the San Joaquin Valley. Thank you all for serving our country, and if you're listening at home, I've posted more information on the Battle of Vianden and the 1255th Engineer Combat Battalion on our website, kmjnow.com. Just go to the Paul Leffler page and look under Hometown Heroes. Before I go, I want to thank Joe O'Keefe of Fresno for helping make today's show possible. He mentioned this program to Lenora Jameson, whose late husband was in the 1255th. She lives way up north in Paradise, but she and her son Dave were instrumental in putting this Fresno reunion together, and they convinced these five engineers that their time would be well spent. I hope it was. And I appreciate all of you who, like Joe, spread the word about our efforts. Time for me to get into football mode for the Bulldogs and Warriors. Hometown Heroes will return next Saturday. Thanks for listening today here on News Talk 580 KMJ.